Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents I Never Said I Love You by Sarah McGee. Narrated by Alex Picard and Ledette Viravong. Part 1. Friends. Liz.
Miss Larkin, it's so nice to have you with us again, said the flight attendant, handing me a warm towel.
Janelle, her name tag read. It had been entirely too long since I had settled in here, 2A, my preferred seat on these trans-Pacific flights. I used to travel to Asia 6 times a year. Now it had been, what, some 2 full years? Better not to study the question too closely. I smiled despite myself, crinkling my eyes. All Janelle and her crewmates would be able to see for the next 14 hours. At least until I slipped my eye mask into place, where it would meet the purple polka dot mask that I wore over top the snug N95. I wondered how I had ever felt like a little hamster rocketing about inside an empty wheel, funking and clunking from side to side as the wheel churns through the clouds, as I had written a friend at the height of my pandemic malaise. Walking down the jet bridge today felt like coming home, and I could not imagine tiring of travel again. Not now, and not in the future. I would not even mind if the flight were delayed. Such was my ecstasy at being back on a plane. Instinctively, I checked my watch and modified the thought. Slightly delayed. I fiddled with my watch, toggling absently between the calendar, the weather, and the activity tracker. The cabin door was still open. I could yet change my mind, I thought, half seriously.
Is Seoul your final destination today?
Janelle asked, bringing my attention into focus again. Not really. Janelle raised her eyebrows. The Asia Pacific was just reopening, and still not too many passengers were headed out on these flights. What few travelers were traveling abroad were giddy with their plans. The couple in the seats behind me had been chattering excitedly about the long-delayed tour of East Asia they were finally embarking on since they stowed their bags. And an older Korean couple in the adjoining center seats was traveling home after seeing their granddaughter here in the U.S. for the first time. She was already 2 years old. Since I couldn't believe my own plans, though, I couldn't begin to explain them to a flight attendant. I pinched myself. Not a dream. Janelle took my jacket and continued up the aisle while I settled in, intent on dulling my mind against the next 24 hours. The whole idea of this trip, everything in the past 2 decades that had led me to take my seat on this flight in the first place.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Captain Douglas, and I would like to personally welcome you aboard Delta Airlines Flight 159 with nonstop service from Detroit to Seoul.
Even after the longest travel hiatus of my life, I could mouth the announcement along with the captain. I settled snugly into the nest I had made, all those glorious pillows and blankets, and dug out the fat pink notebook that was never far from my reach, and rested it against my knees. Something in the action reminded me of the evening I decided to send Now Cow that first fateful message. I must have sat in bed for hours that night, legal pad on my lap, a firm straight line dividing the page into 2 columns. Pros on the left, cons on the right. The page was blank. After almost 19 years, so was my mind. Enough forgetting. The images flooded my mind. A lighthouse, a camera, an overturned canoe, books, little white containers of fried rice and pad thai, the ones with the delicate metal handles, crumbling towers against the unbroken blue sky, picnic baskets and shaggy, and that smile, always that smile, broad and guileless, the gift of a contented man. All of this I remembered that night, as I had remembered it hours earlier, the afternoon sun arcing low, the shadows creeping across the hardwood floor as I took in the pictures spread before me. I struggled to reconcile that the bright-faced girl gazing at me from the fading stack of photos was, in fact, me. For the first time in almost 2 decades, I thought of him. I weighed my options, pitching the pebble into the pond or laying it back softly on the shore, where the water might lap gently, but no ripples would spread,
Dear Now Cow, I wrote. It was as far as I got. Forget about a shot in the dark. If ever anything could be described as a bolt from the blue, this was it. I checked again that my seatbelt was securely fastened as the engines thrummed and the wheels spun. The big bird which would carry me to the other side of the earth roared down the runway and lifted into the air. I wondered again if I had been wrong to ever hit send, a butterfly's wings and all that. I inhaled deeply, focusing on the act of breathing. I was, I knew, as ready for this as I would ever be. I want to go to Laos. I blinked a few times. Sorry, I think you were frozen. She wasn't. Neither the picture nor the audio could have been clearer, but the words coming through Zoom did not compute. It was the spring of 2020, and for the past several weeks, we had been mired in pandemic. Those terrifying early days, when borders slammed shut without notice, and we scrubbed our groceries before shelving them, and lowered our eyes and crossed the street when we encountered another human on our morning runs. My colleagues and I had been working tirelessly as day bled into night, Friday somehow immediately into Monday, to repatriate students and faculty from places a lot less distant than Southeast Asia, although some from there, too. And now, this student had somehow finagled precious minutes on my calendar to tell me that she wanted to travel to Laos, to one of the least developed countries in Asia. I adjusted my screen and drew an unsteady breath. This was my seventh Zoom call of the day. Maybe I was hearing things. Laos, she repeated carefully. I want to study in Laos. Not now, she chuckled, the absurdity of the conversation perhaps catching up with her. But when this is over. I know it won't be easy, so I thought I could start planning now. Laos? I repeated. We don't have any programs in Laos. I articulated the statement slowly, hoping she might catch my meaning. Yes, but I heard from a friend that you helped her find a way to study in Sri Lanka, where there were no programs either. This is important to me. See, each of my parents left as children. Laos. Her face flickered, her words animated. Her hands fluttered near her eyes, but I was no longer with her.
Now Cow. Now Cow Intifong.
I had spent my life being packed around the world on my parents' various sabbaticals, befriending locals in all the far-flung corners of the world, but even to my globally attuned ears, the name was unusual. I turned to look. Like me, he was younger than most of the other students in the class, Pan-Asian, relatively nondescript. Save for wearing blue jeans and long sleeves despite the mercury hovering around 90 degrees. Kind eyes behind thick glasses. Thin. No, more like wiry. Or scrappy. Unsmiling, but then the international students often were. Flashing the pearly whites at every opportunity is a decidedly American trait.
Say that again? The professor asked.
Please, call me Now Cow.
I hated these first day of class exercises. The name, rank, serial number monotony of it. And never more so than when the professor projected such obvious earnestness for us to amalgamate ourselves into one big happy family. Unlike some students who wanted to share their life story from the first day, who were already speaking of happy hours to come, I sat quietly, hands folded into my lap, just waiting for this exercise to end.
And where are you from now, Cow?
Laos.
The professor flicked her eyebrows quickly, but moved on. I've often wondered if it might have all been different if, like the rest of them, I had not known Laos from Latvia. In another life, I might have been the one to ask whether Laos wasn't one of those countries near Russia, the ones that used to be part of the Soviet Union. Or, at a minimum, I simply might not have cared. Absently filing Now Cow's homeland in my mind as another obscure land to be named and forgotten. But whether from a forced march through the frigid ooze of North Sea mud at low tide, my hosts determined to show me a good time despite myself, or my encounters with man-eating mosquitoes and man-hating monkeys in South America, my identity as a globalist was already forged by the time I entered grad school in the fall of 2000. Whether it was the cumulative effect of these hijinks, the international hallmates I had befriended all through college, or merely how I was wired, I can say only that if ever the stars foretold eventual friendship, this was it. Not that I had many friends that year. Never mind that I had grown up in Ann Arbor just a few miles from campus, that I had spent 4 years haunting the stacks and study spaces of the ugly, or that I had spent more hours laughing and lounging in the Diag than any other first-year grad student. I had, in fact, once been hired to give a private tour to the daughter of an A-list celebrity who was contemplating exchanging the sunshine of California for the zest and zeal of the maize and blue. Now I was a graduate student, and the friends I made through undergrad were all graduated and gone. My future was waiting for me to find it, surely elsewhere, and I felt like a transient. I kept my nose in my books and staked out the farthest corner of the law library. The law library was a far cry from the relative hustle and bustle of the undergraduate library, where laughter often reverberated and joviality reigned among the volumes. No, the law library was a place so quiet, but into whose high-vaulted ceiling every sound reverberated, that even a whisper echoed, and you could hear the person 3 tables over scratching notes onto a legal pad. I worked there one summer in high school, wearing heels for the first time simply because I delighted in the click of them bouncing off the flagstone floor and through the cavernous hall. By the time my first semester of graduate school ended, I had succeeded in distancing myself from my cohort such that they didn't even invite me to the end-of-semester bar crawl. "Are you coming?" Naokao asked, before he realized I was unaware of the plans. He and I often sat together in class, sometimes lingering after to finish our conversations. Those snatches of conversation before we vacated our seats when the next students arrived were the extent of my social life. Despite the fact that he wasn't even a full member of the cohort, that he was only taking education courses as a cognate, he was eager for the opportunity to socialize with the others, even if some of them thought he was born in the USSR. Now Cal bore no grudges. I thought back to my 21st birthday a couple of years earlier. The surprise party a handful of well-meaning, if misguided, friends had thrown at Pizza House, my strident opposition to so much as a mention of my birthday, that ended with me stalking out onto Church Street on the coldest night of the year. I had timed my exit poorly and collided with the waiter bearing the large tray of sticky pink daiquiris to our table. Sweet, alcoholic lava flowed over my friends, across the table, and pooled under their feet and on the floor. Months of repentance followed. "You'll have more fun without me, I promise."
"You won't do it just for the show, will you? Because you really do not care what the others think. Is that right?"
He looked at me quizzically, as though truly seeing me for the first time. That might have been obvious from my parries in class, my aversion to collegiality, as the faculty so often referred to the need to pretend we all liked one another, from the way I rolled my eyes when a classmate suggested balancing a departmental budget by purchasing fewer pens and less copy paper. Suddenly it dawned on me what a revelation this must be. What a revelation I must be. Asian societies are collectivist. The good of the group supersedes that of the individual. Full stop. The squeaky wheel might get the grease here, but in Asia, it is the nail that sticks up that gets hammered down. No, it's just, I mean, I'm not interested. It's not my thing, I stammered.
Other people, you mean? We are not your thing,
Naokao teased me, and I smiled, laughed, despite myself. He moved his hand and a flash of light caught me by surprise. Our many conversations during and after class had hewed entirely to the academic, I realized, not the personal, and despite the months of shared classes, this was the first time I noticed his wedding ring, that simple band of gold that delineated a bright line in relationships all the world over.
I miss them.
I had stared a beat too long. Perhaps Naokao had misinterpreted my surprise at my own obliviousness for surprise at his personal life. But now I met his eyes. Waited.
My wife. My kids. Twin babies.
He smiled slightly, as though remembering something.
Turning 1 next month. Ah, but this was the only way, though. A better life for all of us in the end, and it's only a short time.
2 years did not seem such a short time to me to be away from a wife and little babies. But for once, I held my tongue. I'd love to see a picture sometime, if you don't mind, that is. He pulled a worn photograph out of his wallet, and as he passed it to me, I realized how often he must take it out and remember. A young woman with a faint smile and a baby on each hip gazed back at me. Boys or girls or one of each?
Girls. Both. What a surprise.
He shook his head lightly, as though remembering the first time he heard that news, maybe. Or even the surprise when they were born. Do you talk to them often?
I try to call every other week. It's not so cheap, you know.
His nervous laughter hiding what was clearly no laughing matter. Well, I hope you get to speak with them over the break. Maybe tell them about the snow?
Oh, the inanity.
I could converse for hours if the subject was academic, but 5 minutes of small talk about anything personal was evidently more than I could handle. He laughed, though, probably imagining the impossibility of describing snow to little babies whose world was bounded by the mountains and jungles of Southeast Asia.
Enjoy your break, Liz, and Merry Christmas.
Only then did it occur to me how lonely he must be. I should make a point to be friendlier next semester.
Now, Cow. Americans often think all Asian countries, all Asian people, are the same, but they're not. We're not. On an intellectual level, I knew that before I arrived at Chulalongkorn as an 18-year-old, but I felt it there for the first time. Nothing in Laos prepared me for the bustling metropolis that was Bangkok. I adapted. I'd learned to squeeze my motorbike through the least opening, to elbow my way through the crush at the most popular market stalls, to take plain white rice with my meals rather than the sticky rice of home. Of course, the U.S. would be a bigger adaptation. But exactly how big did not hit me until my flight landed, and I encountered my first American. She was a gruff and belligerent customs agent who shouted and swore liberally. "Fucking students," she spat in my direction. In response to my question about the customs form, I blushed, certain every other officer in hearing distance was staring at me, the cause of such a fierce rebuke. Glancing around, I realized no one had so much as looked in my direction. In Ann Arbor, the culture shock multiplied. Professors wore sweatshirts and sandals, even shorts, to teach class. Living alone for the first time, I navigated warehouse-sized grocery stores with 40 kinds of peanut butter and 30 kinds of hot dogs, with an entire aisle of noodles and rice, but none that tasted of home. The biggest surprise, though, was the students, the way they comported themselves with one another, the boys and girls always looking, laughing, touching. They would sling their arms over one another, or offer one another an enthusiastic squeeze, akin to a hug, but not quite, in hello and in goodbye, in the middle of story, or walking across campus. Such casual contact between men and women in Laos was completely unknown. I tried to explain it when I called home, but I could not find the words. In Laos, boys and girls did not touch until they were virtually betrothed. There was certainly no translation for the hookup culture that pervaded from Thursday until Sunday here. Nor could I explain so much else I did not understand about this place where I had come to succeed at all costs. How quickly I found myself adrift from the friends and family waiting for news at home. Northwoods was dominated by international students, most of them married, many with children in tow. My neighbors quickly became my friends. But hailing from the likes of Lebanon, Ghana, and the Philippines, they were no more able to puzzle out the quirks of tipping practices in restaurants, or why the sales tax was not included in the price marked on the goods on the shelves than I was. None of us could begin to understand the obsession with football, or the importance of the game, which collectively we finally understood referred to Michigan versus Ohio State. We were both a part of America and apart from America. "Are all of your friends foreigners?" my mom asked, once over the crackle of a poor connection. "Mostly," I conceded, and it was true. Melissa Miller, Liz, was an enigma more than a friend. We often sat next to one another, and in class, she can alternate between stony-faced silence and jolly good humor in the course of a single discussion. Despite myself, I admired the completely unself-conscious way she spoke up in class and how she questioned what the rest of us frequently accepted at face value. She was not above rolling her eyes at particularly insipid remarks, even those proffered by the professor. After class, we might linger, and she'd chat happily, her eyes laughing as her words spilled out in irreverent or self-deprecating bursts, a million miles removed from the modest, reserved Laotian girls learned from birth. No one would ever mistake Liz for one of those demure women who had peopled my world thus far. Still, it was through these conversations that I first began to understand this new, strange country that was to be my home for the next 2 years. All the same, I would not call her a friend. I was pretty sure she didn't have friends.
Liz. They don't tell you about the ice cream cart in first class. All the times you're sitting in coach, dreaming about what happens up front, and you don't even know the half of it. It is not just the five-course meals or the pillows and blankets by Weston or the bottomless beverage service. It is not even the fact that they let you keep your windows shade open if that is what you want. No. The nec plus ultra of first class, the pièce de résistance, at least of Delta One, is the dessert cart, laden with all the makings of an ice cream sundae at 40,000 feet, to be eaten, no less, with a dainty, heart-shaped spoon. Too many pandemic-laced nights, I had dreamed of that cart rattling up the aisle, the choice of hot fudge or caramel or both, causing drool to spill onto my pillow as I gloried, however unconsciously, in the before times. A small square of brownie, a scoop of vanilla, caramel, hot fudge, whipped cream, and a wafer straw is as close to heaven as a flight on a commercial airline can take you. Actually, the brownie comes separately. But in first class, you are allowed as many desserts as you want. And if you ask for the brownie, it is an easy enough feat to transfer the ice cream from its own little ceramic dish before asking the flight attendant to ladle on the toppings. All of this, Janelle did happily. Ice cream onto brownie, hot fudge and caramel drizzled over the little vanilla mounds, a dollop of whipped cream, and then the wafer drilling into it all. Bliss. I introduced now count ice cream, I remembered. He, a 25-year-old fully fledged adult, had never known the pleasure of such cold sweetness. I lost count of how many times I goaded him into indulging in my favorite treat during that golden summer. Stookie's was closer, but the Washtenaw dairy was better, richer and creamier, and it is possible I tasted every flavor at both that summer. Those ice cream runs, the backdrop of that honeyed summer, were one of the few memories that rang clear in my mind. Of the present and the recent past, I could talk for hours. It was as though everything I had not told Now Cow for so many years was at last slipped of its surly bonds. I told him about earning my PhD, and the program director who had all but asked me to leave the program after determining that my disposition was better suited to arguing cases in a courtroom than the collegial exchange of ideas in academia. He told me he never liked her since the time she wore a tank top and shorts to teach class, something that still shocked him, and a story which his colleagues in Laos never could entirely believe. He looked forward to gossiping about old professors we had once known when we met, he added, and I realized he took it for granted that we would meet again one day in real life, and not merely as text bubbles on screens. Of the fact that such gossiping should take place under the stars, and that this detail was stated not as an afterthought, but as an integral component of the act, I could make, or chose to make, neither heads nor tails. As I recall, I changed the subject. I told him of my globe-hopping ways, of how such continual travel simultaneously fueled me and exhausted me. He told me about the rewards of his work and about his escapes from the demands of it, hikes through the jungle in which he forded rapids and kept a wary eye for ground leeches, those pestilential annelids that could even chew through socks. The hundreds of kilometers he had ridden on a succession of motorcycles, fast and shiny, and made for jumping and dirt biking in his younger days. Sleeker and more sensible, though still fast, as the years accumulated. The time he tumbled down the side of a cliff, his fall broken only by the vines that snagged and tore the skin until he landed bruised and bloodied, but largely intact in the squelching mud.
"My punishment for playing half-naked," he texted, and I ignored the temptation to take the bait and ask, "Which half?"
I told him about Jake, how easy it had been to slip back into a relationship with him, how marriage was the logical next step, how I managed to keep up the facade until I could not. Like Hemingway described bankruptcy, gradual and then sudden. Maybe it was the fact that he had already borne the brunt of the worst of me, this man who had once been my closest friend. But with Now Cow, there was no pretense, only things my brain simply refused to recall. And even now, after hundreds of hours of conversation, I was still coming to terms with the gaping holes in my memory.
"Liz, honey, Dad and I are going to invite a few of the international students in our departments on New Year's Day. Is there anyone in your program we should invite?"
"Hmm?" I looked up from my reading.
"Liz, please. I don't know why you come home if you're just going to keep your nose in your book all afternoon."
"Laundry," I sighed, and my mom laughed.
Even though it could be an ordeal to schlep my dirties home, it still beat washing clothes in the dingy laundry room in the basement of my building. Which is to say nothing of the quarters I was saving or the fact that the clothes actually dried in the prescribed time. I looked forward to my own washer and dryer, in unit, with almost as much fervor as I looked forward to earning a full-time paycheck.
"I said, we're inviting international students to a New Year's open house. Do you know anyone we should include?"
My parents met as graduate students at Michigan State when my mom was studying for her doctorate in European history, and my dad was working on his in forestry. I was born not long after my mom defended her dissertation, during which I had kicked her repeatedly in the ribs, as she liked to remind me. They had been lucky to find positions together at Michigan, where my mom had been in the College of Literature, Science, and the Arts, and my dad in at the School of Natural Resources and the Environment ever since. Their sabbaticals weren't my only exposure to the wider world, since before I could walk, my parents had welcomed international students into our home almost every holiday. They relished laying the table with American classics from fried chicken, hunks of buttery cornbread, macaroni cooked with fresh cream and mounds of sharp yellow cheese, and bowls of strawberries sticky with their own syrup buried beneath mounds of freshly whipped cream in summer, to perfectly golden turkeys with pillowy mashed potatoes, green beans specked with salt and glistening with butter, and homemade apple pies at Thanksgiving. Among her other attributes, my mother was a magnificent cook. From New Zealand and Russia, Haiti and Colombia, China, Israel, and Italy, our guests came. Not a few of them now lifelong friends whose homes I had shared, whose children I knew, whose stories I loved. My parents spoke 5 languages between them, 6 if you counted English, and more than once they had translated official documents in the service of obtaining one or another vital record from far-flung government entities.
"Is Theo coming?" My older brother was home from Beijing, where he was studying at the Hopkins Nanjing Center, and I was eager to spend as much time with him as I could. Once he returned to China, it figured to be a year before I would see him again.
"He'd better. I'm planning to introduce him to some of the students I've invited."
I rolled my eyes.
"You mean the girls.
You're trying to set him up again," I said accusingly.
"Well, I'd much rather he marries a nice girl who wants to stay in the U.S. than one who lives in China and will keep him there."
"Did it ever occur to you that he might want to stay in China regardless of whether he finds a girl there?"
My mother narrowed her eyes at me. We had mined this territory before.
"Anyway, I think there's a guy from Laos in the public policy school we could invite. Now Cow. He's taking a couple of education classes, too."
"What did he do for Thanksgiving?"
I shrugged.
"You could have invited him here, Liz."
"Sorry," I mumbled, aware of never entirely living up to my parents' sociable ideals. We hosted a baker's dozen of international students on New Year's Day 2001, and though it was well after the ball had dropped, and the gathering was billed as an open house rather than a party,
Sample complete. Ready to continue?